Who's your biggest competitor, your biggest foe globally right now?
Well, I think we have a lot of foes. I think the European Union is a foe, what they do to us in trade. Now, you wouldn't think of the European Union, but they're a foe. Russia's a foe in certain respects. China's a foe economically, certainly. They're a foe. But that doesn't mean they're bad. It doesn't mean anything. It means that they're competitors. They want to do well, and we want to do well.
Fee-fi-fo-fum. I smell a controversial diplomatic mission to Western and Eastern Europe by American President Donald Trump. Hello, everybody, and welcome to your Monday Editor's Roundtable edition of The Reason Podcast. I am Matt Welch, joined by my jet-lagged colleagues, Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, Catherine Mangu Ward. Are you all alive?
No.
Yeah, kind of.
It depends on what the meaning of existence is.
Yeah. This is going to be.
You know, I'm definitely in the Karen Ann Quinlan, you know, Terry Schiavo wing of live, but yeah, I'm here.
It's clearly already been one of those weeks. The President of the United States tweeted at 2 a.m. Eastern time, according to Elizabeth Nolan Brown, that, quote, our relationship with Russia has never been worse thanks to many years of U.S. foolishness and stupidity. And now the capital R-W-H rigged witch hunt. I'm, by the way, just pronouncing the end of what's that Shakespearean term where you do the thing at the end? I'm doing that with every two-syllable word for the rest of my life. We're going to get to the multifarious Russian beeswax in a second, but there's a reason why we chose that clip, or I chose that clip, is I kind of wanted to frame the discussion by pondering that for a moment. Catherine, let's start with you. Nick here in his Terry Schiavo phase is fond of pointing out the perils, the dangers of moving from a high-trust society to a lower-trust society. And since you are, you know, conduct ritual hair-dyeing celebrations for the wonders of peaceable international exchange, could it be that at heart, when we ponder Donald Trump, is that he's just kind of a low-trust, zero-sum person in his approach to the world?
Definitely a low-trust person in his approach to business dealings historically. And yeah, I think, you know, the idea of all of our trading partners as foes, and I mean, he explicitly says China is our economic foe. I mean, the most charitable interpretation there is that he's saying, listen, they cheat in the trade, right? Which is what he always says, that they sort of have their thumb on the scale. Even some libertarian types will agree with that up to a point. And of course, it is true that they manipulate their own markets and their own currency, just as we do. But in the end, I think the glorious double thank you, of which I am just as fond of mentioning as Nick is of mentioning the problem with low trust societies, is the main indication that trade, by and large, is not about being foes. It's about being friends. And I want to be friends with everyone, Matt.
Really?
No, not
yes,
at all. Just FYI.
I was going to say.
I just spent the weekend with 1,000 libertarians in Vegas, and no, not at all.
1,900.
Sorry, 1900. My God.
Are they all libertarians?
Dancing.
All of them?
Oh, yeah.
Libertarians?
I think
Peter,
Catherine is the only real libertarian. We all know that.
Well, I mean, that's...
The one true Scotsman is me. God help us all.
Peter, one of those 1,900 libertarians who's a friend of all of ours, who I will protect by not naming, he is a friend of a friend of the president's, and he was gossiping like a gossiper about all kinds of stuff that could make me rich at TMZ. But one of the things that came up was just reconfirming what we already know, is that Trump, as a businessman, has this habit of getting services, and then when people expect to be paid, he just doesn't pay them. And they either have to take him to court and they win, or they're just like, screw it, and they don't pay him. That's like part of his business. Is it possible we didn't examine that? The country didn't examine his sort of applicable business track record and how it might apply to his presidenting?
Well, I think that some of that was done, but it kind of got lost in the tidal wave of Trump news and controversy throughout the campaign, and even to some extent since Trump has been elected. And that's, of course, part of how Trump approaches all of these trade deals is that he really kind of he confuses, for example, European defense spending with payments to the United States. And so he is basically a sort of a zero sum developer type who believes that there's no real possibility of gains from trade and that the rest of the world exists to extract payments from. And that's basically how he worked at when he was a real estate developer as well. Yes, there were a couple of stories about how he didn't pay his contractors. That was pretty frequent. I've heard quite a few more that are sort of that go around in New York developer circles, off the record type conversations. It's really pretty well known that he was just a deadbeat when it came to that sort of thing. But I think the other thing that's going on here is that there is a through line that goes back certainly through Trump's campaign, but even before he started running for president, which is that Trump really doesn't believe in the post-war liberal international order at all. He just finds it of no value and of no use. And I think he goes way too far. Like, you can make some reasonable criticisms of it. You can say, for example, that U.S. military spending is helping to uphold the European welfare state in ways that aren't entirely productive, and that some of these issues should be balanced out and that they're worth discussing. But Trump just doesn't believe in it in any way. And in fact, he's more comfortable, I think, with dictators, authoritarian types, folks like Kim Jong-un, like Vladimir Putin.
Queen Elizabeth.
There you go, right?
Absolutely right.
And this has been a pretty consistent thing throughout Trump's life. I mean, you go back to him talking about the Tiananmen Square massacre and sort of talking about it as, well, they were, you know, they were really tough. And that was something, you know, sort of, I mean, basically giving it the kinds of, using the kinds of language that Trump uses when he believes that something is strong and worthy and, you know, and worthy of praise. And so Trump is someone who really does not feel at home in a collaborative liberal environment like the G7, like the talking with the EU as trading partners, and he feels quite at home in an environment where he is sort of in a one-on-one standoff that is in some ways potentially lucrative with someone like Putin.
Nick,
the sound that you're hearing is only the sound of Low Spark of High Heeled Boys, Matt Welch, who may get that semi-obscure traffic
That's
reference.
That's more than semi-obscure. I think both. I'm looking at Catherine's face
that
right now,
not.
And Catherine's face is like, that's way beyond
so here,
obscure.
Let me, but the real sound that you're hearing, the real sound that you're hearing is Trump delusion syndrome, that this is even this, that we're talking about this. What Trump said in that clip, and you know, and it's always good to expand it out, is that he's look, the EU, China, and Russia are major trading partners. They're major trading adversaries. We're competitors with them. The EU is the single largest, and in many ways, it's the most interesting economic unit on the planet. And it is, in many ways, is eating America's lunch. Partly because they figured out things we haven't done. They created, you know, they created NAFTA, except that it was much bigger and more robust and had actual labor mobility in it. Yeah, we're competing with them. We compete with them for world capital and for people and for all sorts of things all the time. And there's nothing wrong to say they're our foe or as Trump corrected himself, they're our competitor. He said Russia is our foe and our competitor in various ways. China, exactly the same thing. And like in any other context, we would be bitching about how, you know, government regulations that went into place before Trump forced IPOs or goosed IPOs to open someplace like China or England because of things like Sarbanes-Oxley and Dodd-Frank and what like, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. None of this, we don't have to try and do some kind of deep, put them on the bench, you know, on the psychiatrist cuts and read into this, that, or the other thing. I think Peter is right that Trump does not see much value in a lot of longstanding, you know, post-war institutions of global kind of cooperation. I don't think that's a bad thing because in a lot of these cases, those institutions no longer should not exist or they really need to be torn down. NATO, I think NATO being the first and foremost one, and he's right about that. But the fact is that Europe, the EU, China, Russia, these are competitors for us. And it doesn't mean that we have to go into a fighting war with them or anything or speak poorly of them or try to influence their elections. But
these alliances exist in part to keep us from going to war with them and keep them from going
we're not
going
to go to war with
other powers.
We're not. Yeah, but we're not going to go to war.
So you don't think there's any possibility that Vladimir Putin will look at the fraying relationship between the EU and the United States and think, let me test that.
There is zero. You can have my retirement accounts, Peter. If Russia launches a land war into any European country, that wasn't even part of the or that wasn't even territory in the USSR. In the next,
he carved out a Baltic exception.
I heard it.
Yeah.
This is the sort of thing that I don't think. No. But what I'm saying is that you've already changed the subject into we are believing an argument about Russia's expansionist tendencies that helped undergird both World War II strategy as well as NATO. It has not been proven out. Okay, so. It isn't like is Russia an enemy of the United States? Yeah. Are they an economic and global and demographic competitor with us? Yes, absolutely. Trump even said that. So is the EU and so is China. And we're not going to get around. I mean, that's the pretext to come up with better deals. I think Trump as a protectionist is an idiot. I think as an immigration restrictor, as a mobility person, he is despicable. And I hope there's a hell because he should burn in it along with Steve King and a bunch of these other scumbags in the Republican Party. Having said that, what he's talking about here is exactly basic reality, and I don't think we should get all hopped up over comments. Like
I would personally dispute the characterization of Russia as an enemy as much as I'm the biggest Russophobic person on this podcast. Adversary is a fine word.
Oh, well, so now you're saying that Trump is too harsh on Russia because he did say Russia is an enemy.
I don't believe the enemy, nor do I believe foe is an accurate way to describe a trading partner either. I think that the words
competition and foe are different things, right? You can be rivalrous with someone and not see them as your enemy or your foe.
Yeah, but I mean, it doesn't to be a foe. I mean, like, you know, the Boston Red Sox and the New York Yankees are foes.
That's just because foe is a good headline word for the New York Post, I think.
Yeah, it's true. It fits in a thing. But I think there's a direct relationship with that idea. It's not putting Trump on the couch. It's observing that this mindset of the world informs not just his bad trading policies, but also that same stuff that you find despicable, Nick, and that he's a scumbag and should rot in hell. It's all kind of the same cloth, that everything is zero sum, that people are trying to send us their worst people and trying to rig the system against us. And I think that contributes to the very sense.
Who was the person who asked Mitt Romney, who is the biggest enemy of the United States? What reporter in a debate asked him that? And that's when he answered Russia. And was
Wait, was it Matt Welch?
By Barack Obama.
No,
but I mean, it's like this is just the plain language talking. I think it was Selena Zito who originally coined the term, or that, you know, Trump's followers take him seriously, but not literally. His enemies or his opponents and critics take him literally, but not seriously. I mean, I think we need to pull back a little bit. I think we all agree Trump's trade policies are not good and they're not good ideas. Trump's immigration policies are not simply bad ideas. I mean, I think they're inhumane to the extreme, and they are ultimately going to fuck over the U.S. more than the people who are willing to cross the desert to get here. But I don't think.
But aren't those terrible policies the direct result of Trump's view that the international order is not one of peace and cooperation, but instead is one of zero sum rivalries that he should try to exploit?
I don't think it's that. If we could just get him to admit NATO is a really good thing, or the United Nations is a really good thing, things will change. I mean, I think what he's saying also echoes a lot of what many, many people believe and what is basic reality. NATO, he spends a lot of time bitching and moaning about NATO and about Europe, shouldering more of its defense budget and stuff like that. How is that not absolutely inarguable?
Barack Obama made the exact same arguments and also, rattled the cages at NATO summits as recently as 2016.
There
doesn't mean you're right, Nick. I'm just pointing out a little
no,
point
I'm
of
just
fact,
saying
factual.
That is If you're the government that is paying for, you know, what do we pay more than six or eight or the next 10 countries? Defense budgets don't even come close to covering ours. You know, that, it's like, that's
That's a choice. There was a whole period of time in which.
And Trump is doing something to address that.
By increasing defense spending?
I think is. No, that's what I was going to say, is by making other people, you know, gin up more money. Where he goes wrong is by not saying, and by an equal amount, I'm cutting American defense spending. That would be the Matt, the next time you're talking to KT McFarland, if she's even still,
I think she's been disappeared
in the Trump administration, you know, like, yeah, try and get that onto the
table. Catherine, is it troubling at all? I think that, you know, the sort of Jonathan Chait, Trump has been an asset of Russia since 1987 analysis, which we see around us a lot, is just kind of a basic baseline of hysteria looking at Trump's relationship with Putin and his willingness to meet with him, which is happening as we speak right now. I think right now is the one-on-one meeting with nobody else there. But kind of to Peter's point a little bit, it seems objectively true, and maybe I'm wrong, but just to my snap analysis, that Trump is more kind of friendly and warm towards Vladimir Putin, who I think is a malevolent actor, not an enemy, but a malevolent actor on the world stage. But he's more friendly to him than basically any Western leader, with the exception of Emmanuel Macron at this point, who, by the way, was just awesome at the World Cup, if you didn't see that. But is that just weird? Is that something to make you go, huh?
I think it's something that makes me go, well, no shit. Like, I think the idea that Trump and Putin would be attracted to each other and even take kind of pointers from each other isn't super surprising. I know that Suderman has a hot take on the Chait hot take, which is that our hot take on Chait's hot take is too hot or something like that. So maybe we can talk about that a little bit. But
anti-anti-anti-Chait?
Yeah, I think we're pretty a few layers into anti-anti.
I actually don't know how many layers there are in there. And so it could be that I basically think Chait's article is perfect. Or it could be that I think it's almost entirely wrong.
Literally the worst thing that's ever been written.
I'm not personally certain.
Right. So, but I think broadly speaking, that, you know, the idea that Trump is an agent of Russia is absurd. I think, though, that his rapprochement with Putin and his, you know, the fact that they are now, as we're recording, I think they were, as we stepped into the booth, at least, they were late for a press conference because their private lunch had gone on so long and they were just having such a great time hanging out together. And this is a guy who, you know, when he was interviewing Supreme Court candidates, like 20 minutes was enough. I think there's clearly something that, you know, power is attracted to power. The vision of a kind of authoritarian strongman who's also a hero to his people is something that appeals to Trump. He's also, sort of made moves toward North Korea in the same way. And I think, I'm a Trump hater and I'm looking for evidence. So I am aware of my own confirmation bias here. But it is true that Trump is hanging out with the kids that'll have him in the cafeteria, and that's definitely the bullies.
I'm just looking forward to the shirtless horseback photos.
I am not.
Suderman, as a way of jogging your brain here before Nick jumps on you, Rand Paul's getting beat up right now for an interview.
Wait. Could we, before we do that,
You tried, Matt.
Common...
Good effort.
I did.
No, I was just going to say, because you brought up the Chait article, What is the common understanding among us of what does that article say, and then where is it wrong or where is it correct?
Well, I don't know what the common understanding amongst us is because I haven't discussed it with all of you prior to this.
Okay, well, what is your understanding of it,
Trump,
Peter?
Chait. Really,
there's your Freudian slip for the
there's,
day.
There's the Westworld situation that we really need to make happen.
Doesn't look like anything to me.
God damn it, Mark McDaniel, get that cortical fluid in there.
The Jonathan Chait had a big, like an 8,000-word feature in New York Magazine about a week ago that argued that it was at least plausible that Trump had been a Russian agent, asset. That's right. Since about 1987, the first time that Trump went to Russia. And Chait in the article allows for the possibility that this is a huge stretch that is merely plausible at best, and that probably it is not the case that Trump is, you know, functioning in some sort of American style sense as basically an agent of Russia, and that this is not going to end with you know, a Kevin Costner in No Way Out, spoilers, situation where Kevin Costner turns out to be a Russian agent in the very last scene of the film.
For God's sake.
And Chait basically says it's not really, I don't think that this is maybe the most likely scenario. Instead, I'm saying it's at least possible. I think that it is even less possible than Chait does. I do not think that there is a good case to be made at all that Trump is a Russian asset who has been one since the 1980s. I do think that Chait does a reasonably good job of the strongest passage is on Paul Manafort, who has pretty clear connections to Russian oligarchs, including he took a lot of money from them and then he owed a lot of money to them. And there appear to be communications between between Manafort and high-level Russian types, who basically Manafort saying, look, I'm on this campaign now. Let's see what we can do to make us whole. And so basically offering to trade his position of political power to pay off his own debts. I think it is at least plausible that Trump or the Trump campaign had some amount of knowledge, maybe not direct, but at least let's call it had heard plausible rumors about the DNC hack before that stuff was made public. And you can see some evidence for that in some of Trump's statements. Certainly we know that Trump's son, who was a member of the campaign, went into a meeting seeking dirt from Russians on Hillary Clinton, didn't get it, but he was certainly open to that possibility, not just open, actively interested in picking up that information. And so there was an active effort on the Trump campaign's part to work with the Russians to get dirt on Hillary Clinton. And so I don't think that it's the kind of story that I don't think it's sort of this story of like deep corruption. I think that Chait's piece goes too far. And I think that it's the main thing that I think is that a lot of people are misreading that piece and basically reading it as saying, oh, Trump is definitely an asset. It's not saying that. It's saying there's an awful, awful, awful lot of very suspicious connections.
But it's the kind of smear job in a sense. And I actually am more favorable to Trump's broad point, I think, than you are,
Chait's,
Peter. But Chait's, it is a smear
Chait's
job.
Broad point.
What is
Chait's
wrong with all of us today?
Yeah.
Speak for yourself.
I just want to, but I think but this piece, one reason I the piece is being misinterpreted is because there's this crazy looking like murder board graphic that came with it where like all the lines connect all the Russians to all the Trumps.
Do you feel like whoever made that is going to end up like the people who play the Joker in Hollywood and they just go crazy for a year themselves?
I absolutely think that what it really points to
because it's all a series.
Yeah, but that might just be the editors.
There's a relationship. There's a relationship between Putin and the powerful businessmen in his country, which we all know, right? Like the Russian oligarchical cronyism is you know the apotheosis of that form. Like it's an incredibly entangled and corrupt world. And you know this is what I mean when I say, you know, Trump sees something in Putin that he admires and might be considering emulating, which is the relationship between business and the state in Russia. I don't think is something Trump would mind to at least get closer to in this country and maybe even across national borders. And again,
and
I do not.
Trump's family
think
has said that their family business was hugely reliant on Russian deals and Russian money.
And I do not think that the connection in this case.
Clear details on, but they have admitted there's a lot of Russian money in the Trump world.
And I don't think the Russian money in Trump world gives us evidence that there are sort of high level, you know, State Department, CIA relevant entanglements. I really don't. But I do think it's, if anything, it's mostly just a cautionary tale about how you should not entangle banking and business and, you know, unchecked political power, because it becomes very hard to see where those lines are.
Moral of the story, don't nominate Donald Trump for president.
Oops, too late.
I agree with that completely, and I do think that, you know, the story is deliberately written and to be misread, of saying that Trump is somehow kind of like a Manchurian candidate, and that the hooks that got put into him were going back decades, business deals, money, and other kind of compromising situations, both financial and possibly personal. It's all innuendo, and it all adds up, and it all leads in that direction. I think that the corruption that you see there, which is worth discussing, is it's not about, you know, we've got this picture of you, you know, when Trump went on that first Rick Steves, Mario Perillo tour to go, you know, in Europe in the 80s to see all the great pea beds of the classic European capitals and, you know, and at the Summer Palace in St. Petersburg or something, they got footage on him. It isn't that, but it's that Trump is a corrupt person in the sense that he does not see sharp distinctions between business and politics. He doesn't care about those kinds of niceties. People would say this about Bill Clinton and sometimes about Barack Obama, that they, you know, they're ends oriented rather than process oriented. And in politics, every bit as much as in business, you know, process matters. Like, you can't just rush ahead and say, oh, we'll get to the due diligence later, before, let's just sign the deal now. It's like, it's got to be that. And absolutely, this is an outcome of the Republicans being so pathetic that they elected Donald Trump, who, by the way, was also probably the only one of the 45, you know, that casting call, the cattle call of people to run against Hillary Clinton, probably the only one that could have beaten. So you get all of that. But all I'm getting at is this, is that that Chait story, there's a, you know, it serves a higher truth, which is that Trump is a scummy person, and that there's good reason to believe that the Russians feel like they have a lot of leverage on it.
I just think
what
it's
any of it means beyond that, it doesn't really matter, I don't think. And it's, you know, what do you do with it now other than be like, oh, well, we're screwed until 2020?
Well, one thing you do is you see what happens with the Mueller investigation, and they handed down a dozen more indictments last week. My only issue with it, I mean, first of all, I should acknowledge here that any phrase, sentence that begins with Jonathan Chait, an 8,000 word article, is an admission that I'm not ever going to read down to the end of it. But the way the thing that was sold was that and then tweeted out was kind of, was he an asset since 1987? Which that just asking questions of the most kind of a crazy possible endpoint destination.
But yeah,
you
also have to understand what it means to be an asset in these things. It isn't an agent or anything. Julia Child was an asset for the CIA in Europe.
Yeah, hell yeah.
Also for the butter industry.
I mean, seriously, all it meant was that you were talking to people, or you were a line of communication and information to groups. This is, you know, we're kind of mixing. We're assuming that we're in the thick of the Cold War and that, you know, we're rifling through Whitaker Chambers' pumpkin patch because we can't remember where we put, you know, the fucking micro dots or something like that.
Does it not seem at least theoretically? I mean, I guess I don't think that there's really clear evidence that this is the case, but doesn't it seem at least theoretically possible that the Russians have something on Trump, some sort of blackmail material that Trump doesn't want to get out, and that is giving them leverage in their relationship with him? That's what the Russians do, and Trump has made it clear that he is willing to pay to keep information secret.
That's true. The most plausible of those theories that I have heard, and I obviously try to live in a completely fact-full universe and not speculate, is just that since he relied on them so much for helping him with financing, that if they coughed up, they would basically reveal how broke he truly is. And he doesn't like that because his self-worth is based on a completely inflated sense of his self-worth, which seems about right. I don't necessarily think that there's any kind of weird personal voodoo there, although I want to believe. I'll be honest about that. I'm worried. I have read a whole lot of, including in Rolling Stone and I think The Nation, also Ron Unz wrote one of these things before, doing the same thing with John McCain, talking about, is he the Manchurian candidate, literally the Manchurian candidate, his whole story of what happened in prison in Vietnam must be false, and he's taking higher orders from somebody like that. And like, there is, you can build, you can just ask questions and get to a like, well, maybe this happened and maybe this happened and this is ambiguous. And why did he why did he do this? Why did he reestablish relationships, relations with Vietnam in 1996? Why was he so keen on doing that? He must have been an implant. I think there's that way some madness lies. And so we should be perhaps more careful than our good, dear friend Jonathan Chait has been. I want to pivot to Rand Paul, since he's someone our listeners are interested in, and he's also getting beaten up on this topic a lot right now because of comments that he made over the weekend. He was called, in fact, a traitor by a noted patriot, David Corn, for...
Yeah, you'll remember David Corn, who has had not just had all of his limbs shot off fighting in various patriotic wars for America, but then had new ones attached and had those shot off again and again while... helping us stay free.
As he regaled us with stories on Greta Van Susteren's boat, if you might recall, Nick, back in the day. Anywho.
I literally have no memory of that.
Glenn Garvin does, though.
I think I have a vague memory of like falling down a flight of stairs on a boat, which I think I thought
that was last night.
Impossible.
Nick.
Doesn't look like anything
to
me.
No.
So Rand Paul said, if we have proof that Russia did it, we should spend, meaning, you know, hacked into the election or tried to affect the election by doing hackery, we should spend our time protecting ourselves instead of having this witch hunt on the president. I think we need to be done with this, meaning the Mueller investigation, so we can protect our election. And he also said about said hacking events, we all do it. What we need to do is make sure our electoral process is protected. They are not going to admit it, Russia, in the same way we're not going to admit we were involved in the Ukrainian elections or the Russian elections. There's a lot to chew on there. So I'm going to toss it up and see who wants to take a bite out of any of this. Yeah. Should Rand Paul be dragged? Is he a traitor?
Rand Paul is not is a traitor. The fucking guy, you know, gave up a what I assume was a semi-lucrative eye doctor business to become a senator. I think he's a total patriot on this point, and none of that has anything to do with what he's saying. He's totally right. He's totally right, and the only reason people are even commenting on this is because it has to do with Russia. But, you know, Hillary Clinton screwed around. The reason why Putin was activated against her was because she tried back in 2011 to heavily, like openly as well as covertly, affect the midterm elections or elections in Russia in 2011 in an anti-Putin direction. We all do it. And we can pretend, you know, we can stop pretending about it. And I think that the main thing that what Rand Paul is saying, and is absolutely right, we need to maintain the integrity of our electoral system and understand that and just make sure that, you know, that is not getting screwed up. And at this point, in any case, there is no reason to believe that from whatever, you know, and Matt, you mentioned the Mueller investigation, maybe something more will come out. It's far from clear that anybody other than Hillary Clinton was the reason that Hillary Clinton lost the election. There's just no possible way. And a lot of this whole Russian stuff is really a roundabout way, once again, to help Hillary Clinton not have to face up to the fact that she hired Robbie Mook, who is the world's shittiest campaign director. You know, when you read like Donna Brazile's account of the Hillary campaign, and you know, Brazile came within a couple thousand votes of putting Al Gore in the White House. She knows what she's doing to some degree, and she knows how you lose an election. It's all Hillary Clinton's fault. And the more and more that we're constantly fixated on Russia as some reason, yeah, you know, for anything in the world, I think it's completely being done in the service of just buying a Clinton-centric point of view, which is that I couldn't have lost unless it was stolen. That's it. Rand Paul is right in all of his particulars. Using the word witch hunt is not a good.
That's what I was going to pivot from to Peter here. We now have, I think the count is 4 former Trump advisors, 26 Russian nationals, 3 Russian companies, some rando Californian, a London-based lawyer, have all been indicted so far as part of the investigation. 5 people, including 3 former Trump aides, have already pleaded guilty. Does that kind of count, Peter, disprove the witch hunt? Or is that, hey, look, you know, they got a lot of indictments in Whitewater, too. Any focused prosecutor can deliver the rein if they want to?
Well, it sort of depends on how you look at it. If you want to say that the Mueller investigation has been worthless, turned up nothing, and basically gotten us nowhere. I think that's totally wrong. If you want to say that it has proved the strongest and most far-out claims of conspiracy and collusion between the Trump administration or the Trump campaign and foreign adversaries, probably Russia, then I think it hasn't gotten there yet. But we haven't seen the full report yet. We haven't seen the final information and final conclusions here, and it's going to be at least a few more months, I think, before we do. And so to me, the jury is still out. We just, you know, you can't draw conclusions about what Mueller knows and what he doesn't know about where this is going or where it's not. I think if I had to guess, I would say that the Mueller campaign is likely to come out with something sort of weak to moderate to suggest that there was some suspicious, shady stuff going on, but not a sort of here is the link between Vladimir Putin and the KGB and Donald Trump. He's been an asset the whole time. I just don't think that's what's going to happen. But I do think, like I said, it is quite likely that there were some more than shady connections between Trump's campaign and foreign governments or actors sort of acting sort of as representatives of foreign governments, as assets, if you will.
Before we pivot off of this, of all talks Russia, because I'm already fatigued and want to say niet, just point out that the recent Ooh. Spate of indictments include an apparently successful, you know, they're asserting this in the indictment, a successful attempt to hack the website of a state board of elections. I have, and we've done it here a lot, refuted the notion that Russia hacked into the election. And I still probably wouldn't use that precise language, particularly as it concerns Nick's point of like somehow this was the determinative factor. I will never probably believe that unless some crazy thing that hasn't been contemplated is revealed. But they did apparently successfully hack into the information of 500,000 voters, which is an interesting thing to contemplate. And to the extent to which Rand Paul said, hey, we got to protect against that, I think he's totally—
I would add just one other thing that it shows is that it really sort of responds to Trump's earlier kind of longstanding claim that we have no idea who it was who broke into the DNC. It could have been some 400-pound person, you know, sitting in their basement or whatever. I mean, and the way that Trump has sort of historically responded to this stuff is basically to say, well, we have no idea. Like, there's no reason at all to think it's the Russians. And again, this is, you know, it's totally circumstantial, but it's a little bit odd that Trump would treat those allegations that way when it was pretty clear it was the Russians all along. And now the Mueller investigation has made it perfectly clear that is who was behind it.
Catherine, you're a monarchist at heart. You had said, I think, in our Slack pre-chat here that your timeline was still filled with all kinds of leftover weirdnesses from Trump's visit to England and the Queen and all this kind of stuff. He apparently said in one interview that the British Prime Minister wrecked Brexit and therefore killed any possibility of a bilateral U.S. trade deal, said Boris Johnson, the incredibly haired Boris Johnson, would make a great prime minister. And then there was all kinds of other just usual Trump weirdnesses, including balloons. What struck out at you at the chatter that you've seen now that we're nursing our post-Freedom Fest hangovers about the Trumpian visit to London?
So this is I'm now going to go full Tom Friedman on you guys. Not full Tom Friedman because it's not a cab driver, but
okay.
I was flying home from
just take me to Comet Pizza right away.
It was Elon Musk's pedo cab,
which will be powered by fire, I'm pretty sure, which I will totally get and ride. So I was coming back from Freedom Fest, and I had a connection in Philadelphia, which do not do. And I had to run to make my plane, so I like ran through the corridors. It was very dramatic. I plopped
down. She just
down.
Made a little running.
Is that
gift
the first time
in,
that you ran
the sound
since
booth
like?
Here?
Yeah.
Since like the 90s.
FYI, I fully, like, this morning I woke up and I was like, is this what my body feels like after running? This is terrible. Anyway, so I plop down in my seat 1 second before the plane takes off, and the guy next to me is chatty, God help me. And he's just come from London, and the only thing he wants to talk about is the Trump diaper balloon, the baby Trump balloon. And first of all, I want to thank this event for bringing the fact that British people call them nappies to my attention again, which I sort of knew, but is just far more hilarious. But he, you know, he basically just said, as an American, he's sort of walking around the streets of London. And, you know, the idea that these huge crowds would turn out just to kind of say, you're not welcome here. And his take on it was actually that that was a little bit of a misunderstanding, that this was one of these classic protests that starts hooked to a specific event, but then attracts all the people that just like to do protests.
Free Mumia.
There were like the Free Mumia people were probably there and like, you know,
it's the Jews new brunch.
For Jesus. And
Bob. Well, it's England, so there was something about Bobby Sands and the
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was probably some like Irish nationalism happening. Yeah. So basically, you know, I think the one thing that struck me in this annoying dude's thoughts was that he probably is right that what some people are reading as a massive popular uprising against Trump was actually like just kind of fun protest day in London in a place where there's a lot of stuff going on, a lot of other tensions, and Trump just tapped into that. But I do think, you know, this is the kind of thing that people who opposed Trump during the election feared, that he would wander into a standard diplomatic interaction and just turn it into a God who only knows what's going to happen shenanigan. I mean, all the headlines, if you search, are like Trump leaves London after wreaking diplomatic destruction. Like, they're just a bunch of headlines like that. And while I don't feel the need for everyone to be nicey nice in a traditional way every single time, you know, there's not a lot of dividend in pissing off Europe. You know, they are not our foes, as we were talking about earlier. And certainly, you know, England in particular, the United Kingdom in particular, you know, there are lots of fights to pick in this world, and that's not one of them.
I mean, Trump has – this is how Trump acts during diplomatic meetings. He just doesn't – he doesn't know what he's doing in the traditional sense.
He definitely doesn't prepare, which, you know, I mean, we've all been there. But, like, hopefully we
– some of us are there this morning.
Hopefully we wouldn't
in the
be
sound
there
booth.
If we were the president of the United States meeting another world leader. Like, that's a high-stakes moment. And
There were stories last year about how in an early meeting with Russian diplomats, Trump revealed classified information about a secret Israeli raid in Syria.
Definitely because he just didn't know he wasn't supposed
sure.
to. Yeah.
Right? Sure. Oh, definitely because, or maybe because he's a Russian asset.
Dun, dun,
oh,
dun.
No.
Sorry, I think it's right, probably because he just didn't know, because he's kind of an idiot who likes to wing it. I go back to one of my...
Again, we've all been there.
All been there. And I go back to one of my favorite Trump quotes, which was something from like 82 or 1984 during sort of the peak of the Cold War and the nuclear negotiations with Russia. And Trump, then sort of a hotshot, somewhat younger real estate developer, gave a quote to The Washington Post where he was like, look, I can solve this. Negotiations are what I do. Deals are what I do. Just give me 90 minutes to prepare and I will solve the nuclear missile crisis with Russia. Done. It didn't happen that way.
The tidbit that I like, by the way, from the London visit is that while Trump did have tea, I think, even with the Queen, Prince Philip was not invited. And that's because then that's two like loose lipped crazy uncles in the room, which is at least one too many. Like, they needed plausible deniability for whatever was going to happen there. And the odds that Trump and Prince Philip together would just be like, let me tell you, we talked about how hot Meghan Markle is for half an hour. Like, that, the odds that was going to happen were just way too high.
Maybe Philip is the...
She's a beautiful girl.
Maybe Philip is the asset.
Dun,
Nick,
dun, dun.
Nick, you referenced Hillary Clinton and Russian-Ukraine earlier, and part of what Trump did here was sort of to comment about the internal political arrangements and kind of express a preference one way or the other about stuff. As a basic baseline, do you think it is appropriate or inappropriate for a U.S. president to give his or her obvious preferences about another country's politics, political parties, or personalities and like the big issues inside that country?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I hadn't thought about it in quite those terms. My gut feeling would be like, no, unless you're going there to say, during Tiananmen Square or whatever, like that you were going there or you were having a conversation about that. And you would say, you know, it is unacceptable that you would kill or imprison peaceful protesters and make that kind of, you know, take a stand like that. What is going on here is terrible. On a general state visit, for the same reason, who gives a flying fuck whether or not Putin, you know, supports the Astros or the Cubs or, you know, Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump? Like, yeah, like, you know, just go fuck yourself. What strikes me with the Trump stuff, yeah, particularly in England, because America has a vexed and stupid relationship with England, where even though it is, you know, that's the shithole country in the planet. But, you know, but because we're linked to it and we still swoon whenever we hear even like some drunken barmaid with a Cockney accent, it's like, oh, like, you know, she's Shakespeare.
Did
we
you just
take
use the
for
word
granted
barmaid,
like their rules?
Like for reals?
Yeah.
A plus. A plus.
It's come back around.
Yeah. Sorry.
But, you know, we take, you know, somehow we take social cues. Like, you know, the stuff that I was saying is like, oh, he walked in front of the queen, and one never walks in front of the queen. Fuck you. Like, who gives a shit about any of that kind of stuff? There are the questions of, you know, restraint and order and strategy. You know, Peter talked about the, you know, the remarks that were like kind of loose-lipped and that shouldn't have been said. That kind of stuff is semi-important. And even that, I don't think is so much. This is merely the latest version of saying, oh, Trump can't spell. Trump doesn't have good English. He has no words. He's retarded. That type of stuff. That's all this.
It's a joke. I will say I am totally with you on the what I think in the past has often been a strategically calculated violation of royal protocol when American presidents go abroad, and not just in England, but in other places. Yeah. I am all for that. I that's like my, you know, I look for that after every diplomatic visit, is the little bit of like, you know, you're not supposed to turn your back to this person, but we did because we're Americans. God damn it. And like that is the one place where I will.
We don't tip our flag at the Olympics.
What's worrying, though, is not these sort of formal slights. I agree there. It's meaningless or even sort of a little bit of a delight, as Catherine says. What's worrying, though, is Trump's habit of basically declaring an equivalence between the United States and Russia. I mean, in the press conference today, Trump said, you know, was asked whether he would hold Russia accountable for anything, and basically just says, not really. Both, you know, the United States and Russia have been foolish. We've both made mistakes. And he's done this before in an interview with Bill O'Reilly last year. You know, he was asked about Putin being a killer, somebody whose state murders journalists, right? And Trump's response was, well, you know, there are a lot of killers. We got a lot of killers. What do you think? Our country's so innocent. Take a look at what we've done, too. We've made a lot of mistakes. And look, America isn't blameless. It's not at all. And America deserves criticism. But I'm not sure that the right response from the president of the United States is to say that America and Russia, in fact, I'm pretty sure that it is not the right response to say that America and Russia are on equal footing, and that basically, you know, sort of their government and our government are more or less the same and basically blameless. We're not poisoning.
What is the negotiating tactic
Britons
involved in that?
We're not poisoning Britons in their home country. That's not something that we're doing. And the United States government,
we are
much
separating
to
children at the border,
much to Trump's chagrin, is not murdering journalists who are covering the separation of children at the border.
I agree with you completely, but also, and this is the type of thing, if we're talking about political and diplomatic decorum, you know, shouldn't everybody who comes over here be like, hey, you know what, let's talk about whatever business we're supposed to do here, but first, would you stop ripping children from their parents at the border? Would you release the hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people who are nonviolent criminals who are stuck in jails in states that have already made legal marijuana legal, et cetera? And I agree with you completely. I don't see a moral equivalency between, you know, the Russian system and certainly between Vladimir Putin and, you know, any other American president. But you could also make that case because it's, you know, the United States is fucking, as we were talking about this, we're still droning people in massive numbers. Obama did it. Bush did it. You know, whoever succeeds Trump will do it. And so at this, you know,
America
in the
has made mistakes.
World of international intrigue.
But this is the difference. America has made mistakes, has made grave moral errors, even, is true. America is basically the same as Russia is not. And that's what Trump is saying. He is saying consistently, America is basically the same on all of these counts as an authoritarian journalist murdering, thuggish, corrupt regime run by a quasi-dictator who won't step down or allow the democratic process
to
work.
Okay, so then that's the case. So what happens next? Never talk to Putin until he takes it all back or whatever. I mean,
to Putin besides weakening our relationship with the European Union, which has kept the peace for 70+ years.
President's got to talk to the Russian president. That's just, they always do. They always will. And those conversations have to happen.
Brexit and the EU's problem with migrants and stuff like that and refugees, that's not our fault. Or let me put it this way. It's not directly our fault. It's indirectly our fault. Because, the United States unilaterally went into the Middle East and destabilized that region so much that there's a Syrian civil war, which has brought, we got rid of Iran's regional enemy and opponent, destabilized that region. Iran is emboldened. Iran is allies with Russia. They go into Syria on the side of a dictator who's an autocrat and a murderer, displaces a lot of people, and America isn't willing to take any of the refugees who we either directly or indirectly cause. These are all of a piece. They're all of a problem. Having said all of that, I don't see how, if we want to hold the standard that, we need to be more pure in order to talk with people, nobody should be talking to America. And that's not to say America is uniquely evil in the world. This is what diplomacy is. You sit down with people who are absolute wrecks of human beings. And I think I mentioned hell, or I invoked hell as a possible destination. All of these people... If in fact killing people on mass scales is a crime, all of the people we're talking about will end up there one way or another. But we got to, we're also trying to figure out what to do.
Trump's America is a killer too comment wasn't in a directly diplomatic context. It was in an interview with Bill O'Reilly. This is how he talks all the time to Americans, in front of Americans, on American media. That's the view he shares. It's not diplomatic negotiating tactic.
I agree that he is also, some people on the right especially are like, the president shouldn't have to, be nice in his conversation and stuff. It is true. And this, it's a different kind of more subtle, long-lasting impact. It's one thing to have even stupid congressmen like Steve King of Iowa say things that are really beneath contempt. It's a totally other thing when the president of the United States is driving down discourse and basic reality testing in everything he says. And I think I agree with you completely, Peter. Like, the president really shouldn't be doing that. That's what you have, henchmen.
Suderman's going to take a knee for the following segment, but I wanted just to quickly get in there because I thought it was a pretty rich tapestry of exchange of ideas this past weekend that we just came out of Freedom Fest, the annual libertarian niche conference in Las Vegas, put on by Mark and Joanne Skousen. Reason was a big sponsor. We had our Reason Media Awards. We're celebrating our 50th anniversary. Nick interviewed about 1,000 people. I interviewed a couple as well. And we had an interesting time. And I just wanted to very quickly go around, maybe starting with Catherine, what did you learn? At Freedom Fest, what was an exchange or a takeaway that might be of interest to the listeners of the Reason podcast?
My favorite thing about Freedom Fest is that there is always a contingent there of people who will seek me out, and I suspect seek out you guys as well, to say, I have been subscribing to Reason since it was a mimeographed newsletter, and these guys are A, uniformly guys, and B, always a delight. You always get some kind of weird story about I found a copy in the back of someone's van and I started subscribing and I've been subscribing ever since. They always have nice things to say about the current iteration of the magazine, which I appreciate. And, I just think it is a testament to the ideological consistency of the magazine that we work for that people would still be subscribing after all that time, even though Reason's original form was kind of like a, it was more philosophical. It had a very different tone. The magazine has changed so much in how it presents information, but the fact that the underlying principles are the same, I love these old dudes who come up in their short sleeve button down shirts to say how Bob Poole made them the men they are today.
I agree with you, Catherine. That's always has been my favorite part of being editor back when I was as well. Those conversations are a pure delight. And I would just include as one that was reminded to me, Steve Fettig, who's just a nice guy from Wisconsin, who's a co-sponsor of the RMAs. And thank you, Steve. He reminded me of the story about how he got into Reason and libertarianism. It was by literally finding a copy of Reason magazine in the back envelope of a plane somewhere in Mexico when he was 13. And that like introduced him to libertarianism writ large, which is a wonderful story. Nick, what's a takeaway that you had? One of many possible takeaways that you had from your experience at Freedom Fest.
For me, it's partly that what people respond to in Reason, and I agree. You know, I had a lot of experiences like Matt, like you had people telling stories and Catherine sharing stories of things. It actually is, I think, to a certain degree, our even-handedness in terms of pessimism and optimism. Because Reason, despite the fact that most, not all, but many of the editors, many of the, I think even the postmen who carry the magazine to people's mailboxes are depressive. I mean, are clinically depressed people who have, darkness visible at all times. We really also are enough based in reality where we're willing to say, look, things are getting better. And they're getting better in very specific ways for very specific reasons. You don't get an Uber or a Lyft, which is a better thing, without certain types of technological innovation and certain types of policies that allow permissionless innovation. But, you know, that things are getting better and we do need to keep our thumbs on the stuff that is bad and keep pushing down the bad stuff. And I think people like that because I think a lot of political people in general, and I think a lot of libertarians have an end of worldism. You know, a lot of us want to be there when, you know, the shit hits the fan and the apocalypse is upon us. But more importantly, we also want to recognize, and, you know, we were doing a lot of benchmarking of 1968 versus now. There are some truly dangerous parallels or ominous premonitions from the past in today's world, but it's also such a much better place. And it's because of the mindset of people who want to make the world a better place and do it. And so for me, it's always refreshing to see that kind of chronic long-term optimism really being seen as attractive by people at something like Freedom.
I would add that one of the people who came up and said he was an OG subscriber was a guy that Nick and I interviewed that in a podcast that'll be released soon, Bill Weld, the 2016 Libertarian vice presidential nominee. He's like, yeah, I've been reading Reason since 1967.
I knew he was a time traveler. But he copped, he was in the right place at the right time. He was in Boston in the late 60s and everything.
Yeah. But my takeaway from it is just sort of as a follow-up to what I was thinking that I was observing at the Libertarian Party's biennial national convention in New Orleans 2 weeks ago is a sense through people like Weld, through people like the Our America Initiative, who are the rabble associated with Johnson Weld in 2016, but also through people like Gene Epstein. He's like in it to win it to the Libertarian Party now. So people who are kind of more from the Auburn school of libertarianism, there's a flood into the Libertarian Party right now and some interesting kind of juice. I was seeing somebody on Twitter today, I believe it was Jen the Libertarian. Shout out, Jen, who said something along the lines of, hey, look, we tried the whole Liberty Caucus thing in the GOP during the Obama years, and feels like that's a dead end. Maybe it's time to give the LP a chance. There's an interesting fertility right now within the LP, and that's a mental image I'm never going to be able to eradicate, and I'm sorry for it. Let's go, before we leave, to what we've been consuming in Suderman, since you've been taking a knee. Stand up, pledge allegiance, sing the national anthem. What have you been watching?
I'm pledging allegiance to Stanley Kubrick and Christopher Nolan in the same segment here.
Every day.
That's true. It's
like
true. It's
the mourning for Suderman. Like,
they're my country.
What is
so I saw
Kubrick?
For the 50th anniversary of 2001: A Space Odyssey, Christopher Nolan helped oversee a an unrestored 70-millimeter print. Basically, he went back to an interpositive, which is a kind of second stage in the film development process, taken from the original negative, and then cleaned it up using an all-analog process, produced a 70-millimeter print. It's playing in limited engagements around the country. It was here at AFI Silver, and it is utterly stunning. It's just a fantastic kind of viewing experience that really changes the way the movie works. I've seen this movie many, many times.
So you mean it's watchable now?
I've seen the movie many, many times. I've always liked it, but it becomes immersive and giant and sort of enveloping in a way that it just isn't on even the best small screen. And so it's really sort of a tribute to analog. Christopher Nolan is a big analog filmmaker. He releases his movies in 70 millimeter these days. Dunkirk was shot in 70 millimeter, tries to use as few digital effects as possible. And so really it's kind of a time machine back to an older way of seeing movies that I just found really enjoyable. If you see an opportunity, if you're a fan of the film, see an opportunity to see it this way in your town, I would highly recommend it.
Catherine, what have you been consuming for your cultural pleasure?
I have been watching Riverdale, which is keeping with my recommendations of sort of lowbrow series. This is the darker, grittier reboot of the Archie comics.
It's what Batman Begins was to
Batman. It is a delight. It's got a kind of like, it's kind of Twin Peaks-y. It's kind of, I don't know, it's like Stranger Things, but Archie comics is maybe another way to think
Who's
about
the
it.
The Gormagon? What's the creature
magic,
called?
The Jughead.
Everyone, it's like everyone is super, super dysfunctional in Riverdale and the adjoining town, Greendale, and it's pretty good, y'all. The libertarian takeaway is de minimis. The sheriff is sort of corrupt. The mayor is sort of corrupt, but we knew that from the original Archie comics. There's a little bit of black market transactions going on.
Coach Cleats. When is Coach Cleats going to be outed as like the Michigan State gymnastics?
Yeah, no.
There's so much.
That's it. There's a subplot. It's pretty tough to make a libertarian takeaway, but I will say it's pretty good, friends, and it got me through my travel back from Vegas. So,
Nick, how about you?
Riverdale is really great, and it's part. I think it's like in the line of The Secret Life of the American Teenager, which was Shailene Woodley's breakthrough role on ABC Family, which was just a filthy show about parents and high school kids fucking all the time.
I 100% identify with the parents in this show now, which is these children are constantly like, you don't even understand what it means to be a principal person. And I'm like, don't do that, you dummy. Like, you're stop. Yeah. I'm like fully, fully on team parents.
So do you think it's a closer, like a more realistic understanding of what it means to be young today than Lady Bird? Or, movies that get, high praise, deservedly.
I actively chose against watching Lady Bird on the plane. I looked at it, I hovered over it, and then I was like, no, it turns out I still don't want to watch this.
It's pretty good.
Yeah, it is. It's very good. But I on the plane ride home, I started watching Chappaquiddick.
Is that your Lady Bird, Nick?
Stopped.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is pretty much. And I stopped watching it because forget why, and I guess actually it's
because you fell asleep. Let's be real.
No, but I'm like, I'm dying to know how it turns out. And obviously, I know that Ted Kennedy escapes, an imposter comes in, he moves to an alternate reality and becomes Vladimir Putin and all that. I know that, but I want to see the steps it takes to get there. But I love. The first 30 minutes of it are kind of brilliant. And I find it always interesting to revisit these weird political scandals, some of which are more consequential, some of which are not, some of which are more violent and, filled with death. But Yes, I was enjoying that, and I continued to read Frank Turner, the classical liberal folk singer from England, The Road Beneath My Feet, his tour book from the early parts of the aughts. It's just fantastic, and if you are at all interested in that genre of tour diaries, rock stars after a band breaks up and they go solo and start to do better than ever, and then layered in with odd asides about his politics. So, like, even as he's going through a massive phase of boozing and drugging and pilling and all of that, he has an aside about how he really thinks that all drugs everywhere should be legal.
Speaking of Freedom Fest.
And that's really the only way forward.
So my plane ride watching coincided perfectly with the final of the World Cup, which was a pretty awesome game. Commie kickball, as the great Twitter comfortably smug refers to it. It was pretty great. Everything that I watched the World Cup this year is pretty great. And people who understand that sport, which is not me necessarily, also remarked on that. And our own Eric Bame, and I hope I'm pronouncing that incorrectly, wrote a pretty interesting piece about the way that European national teams have been super invigorated by immigration. They're now, all, eight quarterfinalists even were European clubs, which is a first time that's happened before. And it was just super enjoyable and a lot of characters, and it was really fun to watch. In my neighborhood here, which has a lot of French people here, they have their annual Bastille Day festival where they play petanque in sandboxes and they close off a big part of the street. They had that yesterday at the exact same time as the final. I landed, came, and I decided, let's go see what's going on over there 6-7 hours later. And there were still people singing La Marseillaise at the top of their lungs and standing on top of light poles and spraying champagne on people. And it's fun to see people happy. And unlike 25 years ago, when soccer people are happy, there aren't mass deaths anymore. So all of that is to the enjoyable. That's all the mass extinction events that we have time for on today's Reason Editors Roundtable edition of the podcast. Please do subscribe to us on iTunes. Write a review there. Talk about how much you like Nick's allusion to everyone's depressive fantasies here at Reason Magazine. And stay tuned for all kinds of awesome content this week. A lot of it gleaned from Freedom Fest on the Reason podcast. And thank you and goodbye forever.